AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 147 for Friday, April 27th, 2012. Beijing Boats.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another scintillating chapter of AutoLine After Hours. Joining me tonight is Mr. Gary Vassilash from Automotive Design and Production and Automotive Field Guide, and Mr. Frank Marcus from Motor Trend. Welcome, gentlemen. It's good to see you.
Good seeing you,
Peter.
Always
fun to be here.
And I gave Ben some stuff that I'd like to talk about, but before we get to that, what struck you in the news this week that stood out?
Well, there was a really important international auto show that it's very hard to attend. So we had to watch, the Beijing show.
Oh, right.
You know, it's very hard to get visas to go over there. There's hardly any trips and whatever. I think our big boss went, and I'm not sure anyone else did. Well, and he had to go on a tourist visa, so who knows if, you know, he was going to get out.
What did you see from afar that you liked?
Well, you know, the second coming of the LM002, you know.
Yeah, that thing is, you know.
It's crazy, but everyone's trying to get into that space now. You know, we're seeing that ugly Bentley one and whatever, and at least those guys, they have history, you know. They deserve to be in that space, so I cut them a little more slack.
Isn't it remarkable, though, that most of the vehicles that were introduced there were all high-end cars, whether they were sports cars or luxury cars?
Yeah.
And so what is the great populace driving there? I mean, it's just like, you know, statistically, I think it's like 32 people out of 1,000 in China have a car.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of people that don't have cars. I mean, and they're gonna buy that new Rolls Royce Phantom stretched with the champagne flute holders.
And GM showed the ENV 2.0.
Yeah.
And a reader pointed out to me, I read it on the plane, that, you know, don't poo-poo that, because, you know, in these developing markets, when they're riding a bike, that's a pretty cool transportation vehicle. And it is. It's not something.
Especially if it's raining.
Yeah. A rainproof Segway, yeah.
It's not something we would embrace necessarily, but, you know.
But didn't it look as though that, if you look at the first, you know, NV that they had, that didn't have small wheels in the back, or was it no wheels in the back?
No, it was a Segway, and there was some little thing that would, you know, when you came to a stop, it sort of, you know.
This picture seemed as though that there was actually a set of wheels back there now.
Yeah, it's the fact that it's 2.0 is kind of scary, you know, because they're probably working on 3.0 as we speak, but yeah, it did look different. It looked more substantial.
Yeah. And I don't know whether to read that as, you know, a lot of China just goes straight to wireless phones because wiring the country is ridiculous, and maybe the automotive landscape hasn't gotten totally established yet. Maybe you go to these electric things that are too small to offer safety. That's the trouble, is when they pitched Envy in the first place, they were going to be running on these separate roads and so forth, so they weren't trying to defend themselves against, you know, SUV, you know, Urus, Lamborghinis and whatnot.
Yeah.
Maybe it's still, there's still time. They're still building zillion people cities, so maybe you build some of them that just have those things from the start. I don't know.
I do like the Lamborghini, though. I thought it was outrageously.
Yeah, it was cooler looking than those Honda concepts, too. They were a little homely.
Yeah, I don't know. Honda is asleep at the wheel or something.
But, you know, before we leave China, you know, I thought it was also interesting is that, you know, you're seeing, you know, mentioning, you know, electric vehicles, you're seeing a lot of activity around that technology. You know, COTA made that announcement this week about working with Great Wall Motor Company in terms of developing a car. And it just seems to me that, and then what was it, Bob Purcell from Protean was saying they're going to set up a small factory in China for, you know, the electric wheel motor sort of thing. And, you know, you begin to wonder, okay, if these guys go hell-bent in terms of developing electric vehicles, I mean, it's just going to dominate the world.
Yeah, but they've promised that, and they're still not.
But at some point, there's got to be a tipping point. And it's just like I thought it was interesting.
No, and simultaneously, we're hearing from a couple of different companies that are, you know, saying they're zeroing in on the 300 or 500-mile battery. Lithium air, you know, is showing some promise and whatever. And most of the lithium air guys are still 5 to 20 out. But they've got things working now. They just don't have the cycle life. And, you know,
right.
But it's the first time that, you know, I actually wrote a column about it that, you know, I think we're getting to where I might think that might be a possibility someday. I've been thinking, you know, we've had electric cars since 1900-whatever, and, you know, NASA's pumped money into batteries because it's hard to plug in space. And if this is all the farther we are after all that's been dumped into it, I'm starting to lose interest or hope. But now, you know, some of that might really change the landscape. So.
Well, you know, in regard to that, I mean, I did my homework, and so this week ANSI came out with the their standardization roadmap for electric vehicles. Okay, so if you have the American National Standards Institute beginning to say, okay, we're going to do this, and so it's a, you know, it's a 122-page roadmap that they came up with, and, you know, the first paragraph of the executive summary says electric vehicles offer the potential to significantly reduce United States use of imported oil, create a multitude of well-paying jobs to the establishment of a broad domestic EV industry, and reduce on-road vehicular emissions. So, I mean, you know, so here they are talking about, you know, significantly reduce oil, you know, a multitude of well-paying jobs, and these are engineers who wrote this thing. Right? I mean, this isn't some PR guy who is...
But where's the power going to come from?
We got so much natural gas, we don't know where to store it right now.
That's right.
Ah, okay.
So I mean, it seems that there's a lot that's happening.
There's no question there'll be a place for electric vehicles in the mix. They're not going to be 50%.
You know. But you did mention SAE. Did you, you know, have you seen any of the bump about this Tata Emo they were showing down there, which this is Tata Engineering, not Tata Cars. They've, you know, done a fair amount of development, design work, costing, and so forth, and they reckon 20 grand will buy that thing. 100 miles or a little more, something like that. 20 grand before incentives. So if you're one of those states that's paying your EVs, it was like $7,000.
When do they plan on making it available?
They're not going to. They're looking for someone to license it. They've got, here's the design. It's ready to go. Someone come buy it. But it looks kind of sharp.
Yeah. I didn't see
it. You're skeptical.
You know, I'm not skeptical. I think there's a place for them.
They were also in Detroit. They're out in the concourse in the Michelin stand.
All right.
But...
Well, they're based in Novi.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where their offices are. And in fact, they did a significant amount of the engineering for the Nano.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they've got automotive
engineering. Has the Nano been a bust over in India?
I don't think it's lighting the world on fire like they thought.
Wonder why. Just too much money, even at that price point?
Or it's always that bicycle, you know.
Or it's ugly, or they don't care, or...
Yeah, I don't know if people want to keep hoping until they can afford a real car or what. That's sort of the way China has worked out, of course. All these ideas of those ultra-super-cheap cars are like, work a little longer and get a real car.
Right, which gets back to your point of, like, you don't wire the country. You go straight to cell phones. You know, no one buys a black and white TV so they can work their way up to getting a real television set. And I remember some years ago that the Swiss designer Luigi Colani was in town, and I was talking to him, and so he had this magnificent vision of the car for the developing world, and it would be made of wood, and he was arguing that there is no need. And we were standing out on Woodward talking. There is no need for cars like this in the developing world. That his car that he had, you know, and it looked great. But I mean, but the point is that the developing world wants what the developed world has, right? I mean, you don't say, oh, I want to get this wood car.
Which brings me to, we're still in China. Brings me to my column this week was about the fact that there's a danger that the manufacturers doing business in China for as long as the government lets them do business. Let's just say I'm convinced there's going to be they're going to blow a whistle one day and say, OK, thanks.
Yeah.
You're done.
Thanks for the international property.
Yeah. But I think there's a danger of these manufacturers overcompensating for the Chinese consumer, because for exactly what you're talking about, they want the real stuff. Especially luxury goods, they don't want Louis Vuitton bags with dragons on them. They want Louis Vuitton bags. And so the manufacturers are teetering now. I think they're almost at the point of overcompensating, but I think they need to retain the integrity of their brand, and they need to make sure that they don't waver from that, because those consumers are buying into that. They're buying into an Audi. They're buying into a BMW, although, you know, then BMW has a long wheelbase 3 Series now in China. I don't know.
Okay, but to follow that with your column of the week before,
three designs.
Right, but one of the three was talking about how when you were walking through the New York show and you were looking at cars, you could take the tags off of them and you know,
yeah, the sameness in the midsize segment is.
So then it gets back to your, you know, to question your point of, okay, so what is the integrity of these brands?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, the luxury brands are the ones I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the vast gray middle where everyone seems to be copying everyone else. And, you know, I'm talking about the super luxury brands. And, you know, when I was in New York for the New York show, I had a reason of mine, but I did some strolling in some of the luxury shops just to see what's going on, who's going, who's shopping. And there were plenty of well-heeled Chinese consumers in there, and they're looking for the good stuff. I mean, they want the real stuff. And my point was just, you know, the manufacturers, be careful that somehow you lose your way. I mean, you forget who you are, and you just say, well, we can sell another 50,000 a year if we do this. Yeah, but how's that going to affect your brand over the long haul? That was my point. So I don't know.
But if 50,000 extra is maybe 2x what they're selling otherwise, I mean, how do they, from a fiduciary responsibility?
Yeah, well, let's face it. I mean, you know, the Chinese market, I mean, we're going to be an afterthought here. We are. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just going to be like, and I predict that probably in 10 or 12 years, the CEOs of these companies here will all have had on-the-ground Chinese experience.
The CEOs of the...
Of the 2+1 car company.
Really?
In Detroit, yeah. Yeah. 12 years or so.
Yeah.
15, maybe.
Maybe by then, even a presidential, you know, candidate who can speak Chinese won't be booed off the world stage.
Yeah, I don't know. But don't you think Bentley designed their SUV for the Chinese market?
Yeah.
Completely ignoring anything about... That's a perfect example. You've got the Lamborghini, and you've got the Bentley. Now, I think the Lamborghini designers nailed it. There is passion in the design. There's a point of view. There's Lamborghini cues on it. Whereas the Bentley guys just said, you know... They studied, you know, ancient firearms and decided they liked the blunderbuss the best. I mean, there's no rational reason for that except for the pie plate headlamps and, you know, the biggest grill they could get. And it's just ugly.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. I mean, I hope they rethink that.
But wouldn't that have been ugly if they would have introduced it in New York just as the same?
Just as ugly.
Well, and they did introduce it where? Geneva or somewhere.
But I think,
I was hoping we'd have Gen 2 at Beijing with a bit. I think that it has been tweaked a teeny bit. Apparently, there were three designs that they were sort of working with, I think, and I was hoping we'd see another one. If that's another one, then it was too close to the first one, but
separated at birth.
But, you know, I think getting back to this design, you know, my column was that, does design still matter when in this era of the thumb generation, which I have to give credit for that term to Art Spinella, who was on last week. I think it's great. You know, he said, we did our thing on wheels. We were going to meet people. We got in our cars or whatever. It was on wheels. If we gathered together and went somewhere or was in a group on wheels, he said, wheels have been replaced by thumbs. And, you know, the manufacturers are going to have a very difficult time. But another point in my column was that design still matters, even to the thumb generation. That if the democratization of technology keeps filtering down so that a $25,000 car today has stuff on it that super exotics had 5 years ago, then what's going to be the differentiator?
Yeah.
It's image. It's design.
I mean, it's hard to, you know, hard not to attribute a whole lot of Hyundai and Kia's current success to design. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah, they went out and got some new designers and just said, make them nice to look at.
Yeah.
And I think the best example for the thumb generation is look what Apple does. You know, everything about Apple, the way it's packaged even, down just the way they package their stuff, even when you uncrate it, it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
They did that, and they did this, every last detail.
And there, I don't know how many people that are like, oh, my God, the iPhone 4, oh, my God, the iPhone 5 is just in September. You know, I'm going to have one, you know. And, of course, there's a used market for the old ones, but there's all these people that are like, oh, there's a new one that's got whatever, and now it's white instead of black or whatever. I got to have it.
And I think that's real proof positive to me that even in the thumb generation, great design will make a difference. So,
but the question is that, okay, if we follow this Apple example, the question becomes, okay, how many companies in this industry are willing to take the risks that Apple took to establish what they established very successfully? Okay, because if you look at their worthy competitors, right? Where are they? I mean, you know,
I think
I'm buying a Dell. When's the last time you heard? You know what I'm saying? And Sony is in all kinds of a fix and you know, and on and on and on it goes. And so, you know, you got to believe that at some point the guys in Cupertino were sitting around going, you know what, you know, we're going to roll the dice on this thing, and let's see how it plays out. Now, they were highly successful with that. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, you guys as well as I, when you talk to anybody in you know, design community in the auto industry, they always talk about Apple. You know, oh, that's, you know, that's the model. That's the model. But we're...
Yeah, I think the auto companies only intermittently take risks. I mean, they do, but, you know, you can see where they pull up, too. Now, we've got the new guy talked about last week. We've got the two hottest iconic nameplates in American automobile history are slated to be reimagined right now, the Mustang and the Corvette. So we will see. Now, the Corvette has Ferrari 458 Italia overtones all over it, including the lights, and, you know, really dramatic. So that'll be interesting. But to me, that's a transition. The Mustang, though, they made it clear that they're, you know, it's not going to go, they're not going to go to the well one more time and reimagine a 1970.
No, it's time to reboot.
Yeah.
Like the 80s one was, yeah. 79, whenever that came out, yeah.
But does that generation even care?
What, this young generation? Good question. Because I think, you know, the one thing in discussion about, you know, these kids don't care about cars, the reality is they cost too much. I mean, you know, we all go to launches of entry-level products, and these guys get up there, and guys and girls get up there and say, oh, this is for the youth market. They can't afford it.
Yeah.
You know, what you're doing is trying to, you know, trying to put a stake in the ground for the image of the brand and, you know, hoping enough 20-somethings buy them, late 20s, so who have jobs and can afford it. But
yeah.
That note, you know, let's take a brief break. Ben, let's hear from our friends at Bridgestone. This is a good place to do it. I didn't mean to cut you off, Gary. Did you? Were you going to say something about the market?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, and it seems like ancient history now, but in mid-January, Deloitte came out with a survey of Gen Y to see what they were interested in terms of automotive technology. And this sort of gets back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of electric vehicles and stuff like that. That according to this, a strong majority, 59% of Gen Y respondents surveyed preferred an electrified vehicle over any other type of car or truck. Now, they want hybrids. They don't want EVs because it is only 2% want battery electric vehicles. And you know, in terms of the money, and this is where it really seems like ancient history to me. It says Gen Y consumers are drawn to hybrids for several reasons, most notably fuel efficiency. 89% of Gen Y consumers are considering buying a vehicle that gets better mileage, especially true, get this, when gasoline prices rise above $2.75 a gallon. The median price Gen Y consumers see as fair.
$2.75
is what they say is fair.
We saw $2.75.
They couldn't have been paying attention to their mom's filling the gas tank up on the kid child seat when that was there.
Then it goes on. Further, 49% of Gen Y consumers are willing to pay an additional $300 for each mile per gallon of improvement they can get out of a hybrid, only $50 less than the $350 mile per gallon premium that Deloitte estimates a hybrid vehicle currently costs compared to an internal combustion engine vehicle. So
I don't know.
So we're just $50 away to roping these kids in.
So this seems to be an indicate the future is hybrid. So forget this Corvette stuff. Forget this Mustang stuff.
Did they ask anything about warp drive? Like how much would they be? Because I think it's all about as ethereal for those guys, you know?
6 in 10 Gen Y respondents prefer a hybrid vehicle over any other type of vehicle, while a mere 2 in 100 prefer a pure battery electric vehicle. They do want connectivity too, though. By the way, so we won't even.
They want electric vehicle that will go 350 miles or hybrid, and they want it to be connected. And they want this and they want that, and they want it to cost $12,000.
Yeah,
You know, it's not going to work. Speaking of electric, Jeff Immelt, the chairman and CEO of GE, was in town, and he's bullish on the future of electric vehicles. Duh. It's not called General Hydrogen. It's called General Electric. So, I don't know. We just talked about the future. I think it's going to be slow, and I think it's going to be a component of the overall fleet, but I just don't see us, 2050? 50% of the cars will be pure electric? I don't know.
Is it Goen says 2020 is 10% of you know all markets where they're available, but I'll pull out one more visual aid.
Okay, cool.
Speaking of this subject, so I got the catalog or the brochure for the 26th International Electric Vehicle Symposium that'll be in LA on May 6th through 9th. So they've been doing this for 26 years, obviously, and. So, I mean, it's got all of these pages and pages of presentations and stuff. And so the thing that was very striking to me as I started looking at this thing is, so we have the dialogue with the experts on Monday, May 7th. And it occurred to me that there are very few, comparatively speaking, U.S. companies or organizations represented in this compared to people, China, Taiwan, Netherlands, Germany, Korea. Where would the University of Macau be?
In Macau.
Island nation of,
Macau. Okay. You know, I mean, it's just, so here's this whole, the battery electric vehicles general session. Not a single one of these is an American.
Where is that going to be?
In Los Angeles. They hold it around the world. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, it truly is a big deal. And
a Joe Biden kind of big deal or just a big deal?
But so, you know, it gets back to this thing. I mean, so who's going to own the technology? Who's going to have the edge?
I don't know.
That's a question. And yet, I mean, I went to SAE this week and there's enough guys that think there's life in the IC engine that there were three companies there with bold new ideas, better mousetraps. We got the engine block and the cylinders going around. We got, you know, another one of these, you know, two pistons in one cylinder with sleeve valves. We got another guy with a piston with a valve in it, you know. Okay, you know, maybe. Who knows?
That's what I always hear from engineers is the ICE has a long way to go.
Exactly.
Well, see, but I think the thing of it is, though, if you think about it, that the developments you're going to have there are evolutionary and incremental, and they're going to continue to be able to squeeze more out of that thing. Versus if you look in this other space, I mean, that's where the big leaps are going to be made. Okay, and that's where, you know, so it's all going to come down to chemistry and you know, mysticism or who knows whatever it's going to take to get this to happen. But there'll be greater gains made in that space than can possibly be made in the IC space. So it'll look more dramatic. So do you want fireworks or do you just want sort of like...
Well, some of these guys, I mean, if they panned out, and I mean, history suggests they're not going to because most of them don't. But, you know, some of them have these thermal efficiencies in the 50s and 60s and, you know, 30% bump in fuel efficiency. I mean, that would be, you know, a similar kind of, oh my gosh, you know... improvement. Who knows?
But then you get back. Then you get to the question of okay, so if you do that, okay, so you're going to need entirely different manufacturing technology to manufacture that. So you're the guy who's sitting there at the OEM saying, okay, I got to make an investment in all this new tooling and machinery to build this internal combustion engine, or I can build this bright, shiny thing over here that, you know, puts water out of the tailpipe that we'll all drink and we'll put in bottles and we'll sell. What do you make your investment in?
Well, I mean, you know, hydrogen is the next greatest thing, but it's always 20 years away. And maybe electric, who knows? But I think by 2050, the ICE will still be the most dominant.
And there were electric things that were cool there, too. Brabus and Protean, you know, were showing this E-Class and the idea there, Protean's got an interesting idea. Let's retrofit. Let's make cars really easy to retrofit. It fits in the wheel. It just mounts to the upright, and you just put high voltage power and control, three wires to the thing, the electronics, all the regen, everything happens in the wheel, very simple. And this idea was, hey, let's electrify the Berlin taxi fleet. You know, at the stroke of a pen. Okay, you know. And it's Brabus, so it's got big tires, and it looks kind of cool, and, you know. And they take it from a 9-second car down to a 7-second car, or something like that, acceleration-wise. Okay, you know, kind of neat. And then there's another couple companies there showing the asynchronous, non-permanent magnet, no rare earth metal, you know, things going on. And there's probably some future for that, too.
Right.
Of course, my favorite example of that is the nose landing gear, you know, thing to tow your airplane around using the APU instead of a tug. I think that's cool.
Yeah. So, Frank, what have you driven lately that is noteworthy?
Well, we were talking. I was late to the party on the new Acuras. There was a local drive last Thursday, and I drove the new ILX and RDX, and we were kind of... You know, here's another one where we're going after those young people that haven't started having kids yet, and they've got their first really good job, and they want to make a mark and so forth, and we're going to sell them this Acura Civic-based thing, you know. And what do I know? I'm the end of the baby boom, so I chose as my driving partner this 20-something dude that was there, and I'm like, all right, you know, you tell me. And he's like, I don't know. My friends don't have this kind of cash. It's not going to happen. And if we did, we'd probably, you know, want, like, an off-lease BMW, you know. Okay. He wasn't too wild about it.
Was there anything to distinguish it from a Civic?
Yeah, I mean, it looks totally different. All the sheet metal's new. Completely.
Yeah, no, I've seen the car, but does it drive any different? Or?
Well, the hybrid sure doesn't. I mean, that's pretty much, let's just drop that right in there. The 2.4, 6-speed gets around pretty nice, you know. That one sounds good, at least. You can rev it out, you know. The 2-liter, you know.
Yeah.
Just kind of okay.
What about you, Gary?
I liked the RDX. Frank was a little lukewarm on the RDX, and... I think that...
What's better about it?
I just think that the powertrain is much improved.
Way smoother with the V6.
Yeah, it's smoother than you know, the turbocharged engine was in the last one. I mean, the interior is a hell of a lot nicer. And, you know, and it wasn't... I mean, in terms of the interior of the last one, I mean, I think they did a pretty good job. And this one, they just upped the ante on that.
I just don't like the language in those, any of the new Acuras. A zillion buttons in the middle and a knob and all the things around. I just don't like it. I'm kind of waiting for them to double-click and move on to a new idea for all of that.
I don't know about the brand itself. I mean, at one point, it seemed to have a reason for being. I'm not so sure. I mean, every time they sort of get it, they sort of go off the... You know, they fall off the rails. Now, they showed the super sports car.
So maybe the NSX will be their north star, and they'll.
I hope so.
And it's sharp. I really like that, you know. And maybe they'll get it right on the new TLX, which we expect to replace the TSX and the TL, and bump ahead of the ILX, move, you know, separate from the ILX. But
no, speaking of, you know, electric vehicles or hydrogen vehicles or whatever, we were also talking. I just turned in the natural gas Civic.
Oh, geez.
How was that?
And you know, it's one of these, you know, in 20 years, we'll all have one of these things. You know, I mean, the thing is the, you know, this really proves the infrastructure problem, okay? That, so from my office in Plymouth, I had to drive to Ypsilanti to get fuel on this thing.
Oh, boy.
So I had a 42-mile round trip.
It's like having a hydrogen
car. A third of your range or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just crazy. I mean, it was just, and so, you know, if you live next door to the station, it'd be absolutely great. I mean, because the equivalent price of fuel was $2.64 a gallon.
Or if
you had the fill thing in your house, it'd be brilliant. But just for a normal civilian who have to drive that thing,
yeah, and that's still, I think, the most expensive Civic money can buy.
I'm not sure on that.
I think it's above the hybrid. I had to check again. It was for a while.
Those tanks are not cheap, you know, versus a blow molded piece of plastic that some gas tank.
Yeah, but I mean, battery isn't cheap either. I always thought it was sort of weird. I thought it was something to do with, you know, we had to homologate this, and the price of that is expensive, and we're, you know, I'm not sure it was all bill of material.
But this one is 50 state car, and the last GX they were basically selling in New York and California and maybe another state, and so I think that maybe they're being able to amortize the cost of that right across the thing. But that was an interesting experience to have that car.
I still regret that Honda didn't do a non-hybrid version of the CRZ like they were talking about. Because when I see a CRZ, I said, boy, that's a pretty good-looking car if they had a real drivetrain in it. That might start that whole thing all over again. But they're just not thinking like that. I don't get it. Mm-mm. I really don't get it.
And, you know, the new big boss, Takanobu Ito, makes all the right noises. He really sounds like, yeah, we got it wrong. A bunch of guys took their eye off the ball, and, you know, we're riding the ship here.
But
the RLX,
it's 3 years away.
Yeah,
what they're doing,
and some of the stuff we're starting to see. You know, he's been there what, 2 years, I think. You know, so I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. What did you think of the RLX in New York?
I didn't care for it. There's no compelling thing around it. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, they've got a lot of ground to catch up in that space. That particular car has been off the radar for so long. They needed to move the needle.
And because they've always needed to move the needle. And whenever they say, okay, we're moving the needle, please gather around, they show us just like, what are you guys doing? You know, it's not moving the needle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's technology is jammed in it and all that, but they're lacking design point of view. They get it right on a few things, the new NSX, the CRZ, and then it kind of just wanders around after that.
Like Clarity. That should be the Accord.
Yes. I love the Clarity. It looks great.
Yeah.
But I don't know what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, they don't have any ghosts of Bill Mitchell and Harley Earl in their design department that gets stuff done.
Yeah.
It's just not done.
Well, but how much of it is if you take guys like Mitchell or Earl that, you know, they truly knew what they wanted and you know, the corporation be damned and we're gonna make it happen. And how many organizations today, which gets us back to this Apple discussion, how many organizations today have someone who is willing to, you know, draw the line in the sand and fight for what they believe is the right thing to do versus saying, well, you know what? You know, if we take that edge off there and we sort of like mellow that out over there and we get rid of that detail there, that, you know what, we're going to sell probably 50,000 more a year. And then the other guy goes,
yeah, it's almost unfair to bring up the Earl and Mitchell eras because it was a singular era. I mean, it was, you know, GM dominated. The divisions were left to fight amongst themselves. I mean, today we're sort of seeing a version of that with Volkswagen. I mean, they actually let these brands sort of, you know, they encourage them to exist on their own. And forever, however long they keep it up, I mean, it could easily go off at any moment if Dr. Piak decides to do something that just throw a wrench in everything. I mean, he still wants to bring the Phaeton back to the U.S. I mean, who knows? But the closest thing to GM in its heyday right now is Volkswagen, letting these brands breathe on their own. And, you know, and they make so much money. So that helps.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not a design expert. And did the Cadillac guys luck out? They go, hey, let's do this art and science thing. And that worked. People liked it. And the Acura guys said, let's have the beak and this line that goes back here. And it's very, you know, and people just didn't like that as well.
Well, I mean, you know, that's an interesting point because Cadillac, I mean, that was so dramatic. I mean, we all remember when they showed the original Evoque show car. I mean, it was stunning.
Yeah.
And we all said, well, yeah, but they're not going to do anything with that. And they did.
Yeah.
It wasn't so good early, but, you know, it came together nicely in the CTS. But I think you see other car companies saying, well, we need a new face. I mean, the most obvious one is Lexus. You know, they've got that new face, but, you know, they literally looks like they welded it up in the shop and back and hung it on the front of the car and say, see, that's our new face. But, you know, there's more to it than that. And I think Acura did the same thing. That's our face. And well, it's not a good face. You know,
yeah.
No, it's kind of, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, to your point of did Cadillac, you know, win the jackpot and, you know, why did that happen? I think a lot of it has to be a crapshoot because, well, I mean,
of course.
Because who's going to be able to clinic themselves to success?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I don't know if either of them did clinics. And I would be, you know, my gut is to cheer for the ones that didn't because people don't know what they want till you show it to them.
Exactly.
That's
why I cringe and, well, it clinicked really well. Really? Did it? You know? Does anyone like it?
Yeah.
Well, no, but a clinic one. Oh, okay.
Because they had never seen it before. It's like, ooh, it doesn't look like anything I've seen. I kind of like that. It's new. And, well, you know.
That's like you get enough.
Now imagine there's 100,000 of them out there. Do you still like it?
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many focus groups I've sat in my former advertising life. And it's all the same. You get people in the room. The dynamic of the focus group environment changes. They say what they think people want them to say.
Yeah.
And they say, well, what do you like? Well, I want good value and efficiency and
Oh, safety.
Safety.
Oh, I love my family.
And then if you somehow get another group down the road in the same two-day death march of a session, you discover that they talk about that stuff, but then you somehow stumble upon what they really want. I said, no, I want to go fast. I want it to look good. You know,
I want to feel proud when I walk up to it.
I want to feel good walking up to it. I want to feel good walking away from it when I look over my shoulder at it. You know, that's what people want. Or it's like, you know, you get a focus group and, you know, I'm not stereotyping, but a lot of the female focus groups, they'd all say what they think everyone wants to say.
Mm-hmm.
Safety, efficiency, you know, value, you know, safety again. And then I never forget one focus group. There's women, and I sent in a question, and because there was this one who was talking that, and sort of nice, said, ask her what she drives. And she said, oh, I drive a Mustang GT. What? And then, well, and then the moderator said, well, then, but you said, he said, yeah, I said that, but, you know, I want a car that does this and that. And it's, he's just like, oh, well, we just wasted $300,000 to find out that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you think about it, it's just like, you know, we can be and are often wrong. Because remember when Audi came up with its new face and everybody, like, decried it? You know, it's a horse collar grill. What are they thinking of? Why do they have
that? That Avus concept.
And everybody just ripped them. And they just stayed true to course. It's been modified. But basically, this was despite, you know, our best trying to beat it down. And I think that shows a lot of...
And getting back to my point, I want Audi to stay the course. They believed in it, they went for it, and they did it.
Right.
You know, they don't need, you know, comments in from the peanut gallery to all of a sudden say, oh, that might not work in China, we're going to go this way. No, that's who they are. I want these luxury brands, the luxury performance brands, be true to yourselves. Be careful, these new markets, because they want what you are, you know, more than anything else.
Jaguar seems to be getting it right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
You don't like the new F-Type?
Yeah, I do like the F-Type.
And the XF, I mean, I think they've... In terms of saying, okay, yeah, we used to look like that, but what we were going to compare is how much that made you go, wow, in the day. And we just, as long as the new one makes you go, wow, today, it doesn't need to look like
that. Well, I think what they did is that, you know, if you go way back, right, and it's just like, and you looked at the lines and the sex of the sheet metal that they'd had. And I think now they're trying to get back to that. And there was this whole period in between where they became...
They got lost.
And you know, like, we're going to be British and we're going to be stuffy and we're going to, yeah. But I see what I think you see. I mean, it's just like, you know, Ian Callum is doing a great job over there.
I'm more curious about the scale of the F-Type, you know.
Yeah.
What kind of a footprint it has on the road. And you know, I don't know what that'll be. I mean, yeah, I kind of do, but you really don't until you see it. And that, this is a good point. Ben, I've been a little late, so let's hear from our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
And it's also time for that wonderful and wacky time in the show, Rapid Fire. Ben, let's run that. Okay. Mitch W. asks, have we reached the point where smartphone integration in cars has changed the character of driving manner in general? I mean, people don't pay attention, people don't care. They're more interested in getting a good connection. Well, so much of driving today is tedious. I
also get the impression that the industry is relenting and deciding that, yeah, that it's, we can't do anything about it. And so they're automating more and more, and they're getting more and more, okay, we'll steer for you if you go and run out of the lane and all that kind of business. I mean, the Google Priuses are a little ways off, but yeah, there's a couple steps this side of that that are real close.
I don't know if the cell phones have changed the character of driving today, but I think just a lot of things have impacted.
Well, I don't think it's smartphones. I mean, even just plain cell phones that make it so much easier to connect with people. It's sort of funny. I saw a bumper sticker today, and it was on the back of a new Explorer. And this was a real bumper sticker, not, you know, that somebody turned out. And it was like, you know, I'm not talking to myself. This vehicle is equipped with Ford Sync.
All right. Well, here's a comment from Tim. Will the sixth generation Camaro design be an evolution of the current design or be an all new design? It is going to be on a different platform, correct, and smaller and lighter, because they really want the weight out of it. I mean, the ZL1 is cool, but it's heavy.
They're all heavy, yeah.
Yeah, they're all heavy.
And I'd be surprised if visually it looks, the form changes significantly. It may shrink, but I don't think it'll be like, what am I looking at?
Yeah, no, it'll be more compact, and I'm guessing 500 pounds lighter than that platform. Frank says, I know Sergio Marchionne is not one of your favorite car execs, but Chrysler is going great guns. He may be a blowhard, but he's getting results. Except for the Chrysler 200 and Dodge Avenger, there's not a dog in their lineup. Thoughts? Gentlemen?
$473 million profit today?
Yeah. 2.69% margin.
Johnny Mack pointed out that margin is dangerously slim.
Hey, but it's the right side of the zero.
But it's, boy, the media loves it, though. I'm not going to.
So I drove the Dart last week, and I can't talk about it. But
everyone, yeah, Todd can't either, but he's like, you know, I'm going to, it'll be nice things when I can talk.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on it, because the peanut gallery doesn't want me to comment on Sergio anymore. Victor M. Castaneda Jr. asks, so now that the Viper is an SRT and not a Dodge, where can you buy one? Will it be sold at Dodge, Chrysler, Jeep, Fiat, and or Maserati dealers? No idea.
Probably all of the above.
Yeah, all of the above.
Yeah, that's about the same store anyway.
But how many is very limited number that they're going to build, right? I mean, isn't it something like 3,000 or 5,000? Wasn't that?
Yeah, I think 3,000, something like that.
So how many? You know, because all those dealers now are basically, you know, it's like one store. So I don't think there are standalone Dodge stores.
Yeah, but there's certainly Maseratis aren't dueled with many of them.
Right, but I mean, if you just take that out of the mix, though, and you just take the traditional, you know,
the Fiat, I think, are different too. But yeah,
Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep dealers. How many are there in the United States? So yeah. I'm going to guess that maybe you could have one in each dealership.
I think what they will do is they will really pump up their factory delivery program. I bet you they do that. But you'll still be able.
So you go to Connor Avenue and.
I'm sure
up there.
That, no, I mean, you'll be able to get one at your dealer. But I bet you they try to do what Chevy does with the Corvette, you know, make a big deal out of it.
Oh, they charge extra for that. It's a line item on your thing.
Yeah. What is it, like a grand?
$300 or something. It's not huge, but it's, you think, come on. Audi and everyone in Europe takes delivery, a lot of people, some high percentage at the factory.
Yeah, nobody.
And they have fun, beautiful customer experiences and so forth.
The aforementioned Volkswagen Group Autostadt. That's the most magnificent thing. You know.
Yeah, and the Audi Centrum is fantastic, and Ingolstadt, it's...
You know, the first Four Seasons in Germany was built at the place where you pick up your your Volkswagen.
Where they have the giant dispenser of cars.
Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful.
Clem Zarabsky comments that the reason all the cars look alike because they put them in the wind tunnel and the best MPG. I wouldn't agree.
I don't buy that. Because you sure can't tell aerodynamics by looking at them. The same 2.28 can look a million different ways.
Exactly. Austin asks, what do you think of the GT500 being officially rated at 662 horsepower, 630 pound-feet of torque, with 1624 miles per gallon to boot?
You know, at the risk of sounding like, you know, was it Music Man, everything's up to date in Kansas City, they've gone about as far as they could go. I keep thinking, this is it, man. From now on, it'll be lightweighting and, you know, power to weight might go up, but we're not going to get horsepower much bigger than this.
I mean, I think it's cool. I mean, I've, you know, more horsepower to me is always good.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, I'm for it.
And it'll be obvious when, you know, in about 20 years I'm driving around in something that, you know, they almost throw stones at for being so incorrect. Ray Schaefer.
What do you mean, almost?
Yeah. Ray Schaefer says, can you guys shed some light on the reason behind the Ducati acquisition by Audi and why Audi and not Volkswagen Group? Well, I can say that, first of all those guys over there are bike freaks. They like Ducati. The rhyme or reason for buying Ducati, when you look at the numbers, is zero. But it was another way that they can get their buddies across the way at BMW.
BMW, sure.
I mean, it was flat out a play because we're, you know, they're going to meet their enemies wherever they're at. And I mean, when you look at the numbers, it's like, what did they swallow, like $1 billion worth of some debt or just? But
is there an Asia upside potential on there that they're looking to exploit, do you think?
Well, I don't know. The other thing I point out, this will be the first time that an actual engineering-oriented concern will own Ducati in 15 years. They've been owned by investment companies and that sort of thing. So that might be interesting. I don't know. But they basically paid a bunch just to say, it's cool. We can have Ducatis now in the Audi garage.
The executive garage?
Yeah. Let's see. When will Mazda redesign Miata? Jan's 1965 sent this on Twitter. Which direction will they go, bigger or smaller? Have they telegraphed that all? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's coming. This is, we're toward the end of this one. It's coming soon. I think it's lighter for sure.
So it's smaller. Sky Active?
Yeah, Sky Active stuff.
Boy, that's a stretch, that name. I don't know. Lincoln John says, what happened to the design wheel body cutouts? Everyone has the same look. That is, the openings follow the exact circular shape with the flat vertical side. What's up? Well, they're not all alike. But George from Brooklyn asks, will Lincoln ever make another two-door coupe? I would say that's a pretty safe bet, but not anytime soon.
Yeah. Ever is a long time.
Tim asks,
will there be Lincoln?
Huh?
Will there be Lincoln?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do.
What do you think, Frank?
Yeah. I think they're getting a little, I mean, the new MKZ looks pretty good. I think they're getting a little.
If they do it right and they understand the time it's going to take, I think they got a shot. Tim asks, is Audi's Choice of Mexico, does it have anything to do with UAW actions to unionize the Volkswagen Tennessee plant? Who knows? Probably didn't help.
I mean,
logically, you would have put the plant right next to the Tennessee plant and save.
But how big is the Volkswagen Puebla plant? I mean, isn't it enormous?
Yeah.
I mean, so Volkswagen has an enormous footprint in Mexico. So I think to them, it's, you know, you just look at North America and think about the exchange rate.
Yeah. Beauregard Jackson says, with the news of a huge price premium for GM's new CNG trucks, can we expect anyone to buy these things? What is it, $11,000 premium? Probably not.
But isn't that a fleet play?
It is. It's a central everyday kind of a situation.
If you're a natural gas company, it might be.
Yeah, I mean, if you're any kind of delivery company,
we're getting this pull now because, of course, we had a mild winter and there's all this glut of natural gas and everyone's going, man, this stuff is cheap. And someday when things go back to normal, some of that enthusiasm might trickle off. I don't know.
But I just wonder whether, I mean, there'll still be a substantial delta between the cost of.
I think those at 260 versus 350 or 4, you pay that off PDQ if you've got a medium, you know.
Right.
If you're delivering stuff and whatever.
Oh, yeah, Ben, let's go for a call since I've.
Lifeline.
Hey, Ben, howdy. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio, calling. This is perfect, Mr. Marcus there from Motor Trend.
I got it back.
My comment and my question are all related to Motor Trend. First of all, a little suggestion. Mr. Marcus, your magazine is fantastic.
Thank you.
I get 10 magazines a month, and it's on the top of my list. So Autoline After Hours, guys, if you haven't picked up a Motor Trend lately, do yourself a favor and pick it up.
My publicist.
Okay, back to my comment. In June's issue, this month's issue of Motor Trend, they had an article about the Delta Wing engine. The manufacturer, the original engineer, was Arnaud Martin. It's a 1.6-liter engine. And they stated that this is the same engine that won the 2010-2011 World Touring Car Championship under the hood of a GM Cruise race car. I'm confused. GM, Nissan, how does this all fit together? Did GM drop the ball? Nissan picked it up?
Can
you kind of help me out?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Enbug, for exposing something that I've been sitting on for months. But, you know, these manufacturers regularly engage, quote-unquote, suppliers, you know, high-performance suppliers, engine suppliers. Look at the new Chevy engine, you know, Indy engine, that they work in conjunction with Ilmor. They rarely do this stuff in-house. Now, there's a manufacturer of engines, high-performance engines, in England. Yes, GM did use that manufacturer for its touring car championship cars. That same manufacturer also had the ability to do business elsewhere. There's some small fee that they have to pay to GM, and I won't comment any further on it because it's I just can't. But yeah, that happens more than you think.
Yeah.
Okay, comment from Dr. Botox. This is a good one. My father-in-law, a Korean War veteran, needs a new car to replace his Cadillac DeVille, so my wife and I took him shopping, and we looked at the Azera, a near-luxury car, for an octogenarian, but it comes with 40 series tires. One pothole and it's time to replace the wheel. Why performance wheels and tires on a car for geezers? Well, I don't know as if Hyundai would like to hear their Azera be referred to as car for geezers. By the way, we bought him a Chrysler 300 with a Hemi and all-wheel drive. He likes big barges. Cool. I saw photos of the... this is still Dr. Botox. I saw photos of the updated 2013 Chevy Traverse and was surprised to see the distinctive Chevy twin port grille missing in its place as a generic...
I
thought it was pretty good. I mean, there's some things about it I really like. I like John Caffaro a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think his team did a nice job on it. But again, it's similar to, from some angles, to the LaCrosse. It's similar to, that discussion in the New York show. I think it's pretty good, you know. I think it'll look good on the road. I really think the XTS is going to look great on the road.
Do you think it'll draw enough retail customers to change the mix there. That's
the
been
fleet.
Heavy, heavy, heavy fleet.
Yeah, I think it's got a shot at it. I really do.
But then what's the fleet going to drive?
I don't know, but there's strong indications that the Chevrolet NASCAR special is going to be called the SS. Not a big surprise. Comment from Roman Coke. Why is the new face of every car a hexagonal grill? See Fusion, Genesis Coupe, and now the Avalon. Who's next? I don't know.
Mitsubishi sort of had that yeah. shape before yeah. any of those other guys
it
did.
It's sort of sad, though. It's not compelling.
01235 asks, pound for pound, the new Dodge Viper SRT race cars versus the Chevy Corvette race car. Which one do you guys prefer? And please don't give me all that Corvette history. Me, I prefer the new Viper. Well, I'm glad you prefer the new Viper, but that race car Viper is basically a cobbled-together show car that they have not run. There's no development of it. There's no development program ongoing. They wanted to make a splash at the New York show, and they've got a long way to go with that car before it's even remotely competitive in GT ALMS racing. Whereas the Corvette, they're on their fourth or fifth generation race car.
Highly there you go with that history stuff.
Yeah, there's that.
He just told you not to do that.
Yeah, but, you know, if you ignore history, you know what happens.
At your peril, yeah.
But you know what? Remarkably enough, we've reached the end of the road, folks. You know, I'd like to thank Gary from Automotive Design and Production, Gary Vasilis. Thanks for coming. And AutoFieldGuide.com. And, of course, Frank Marcus from Motor Trend. Frank's always a pleasure. Thank you guys for coming. You can get all of Frank's stuff over at MotorTrend.com. Get all my stuff at AutoExtremist.com. And wait, I do have a new Twitter handle. This just in, folks. My Twitter handle is Peter M. DiLorenzo. So, you know, you heard it here first. And also, Auto Extremist is on Facebook, but I never go there, so neither does anyone else, apparently. And you can friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. You can follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And I guess that just about does it. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Thanks for your comments and questions, and we will see you next week.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.